The following program is intended for blind and print-impaired listening audience and is presented by the North Carolina Reading Service. Indie Week, The Independent, read once a week, and today's reader, John Federson, will bring you the issue dated December the 12th of 2024. And welcome to our broadcast, which is a podcast, actually, and it will be first broadcast on Friday, December 13th, but I'm recording it, as usual, on a Thursday afternoon. And I've got some hard news and some features for you, and let's delve into that. First off, from Durham, officials attend a groundbreaking for Durham bus station renovations. The downtown Durham bus station is getting a major facelift. On Monday, public officials and other stakeholders met on the second floor of the downtown bus station to celebrate this groundbreaking for a $26 million renovation to the transportation hub. Mayor Leonardo Williams said the renovated station, which was originally designed by nationally renowned architect Phil Freeland, would allow the station's 14,000 daily riders to have a renewed transportation experience as they traverse the triangle. And he went on to say, as Durham continues to be one of the nation's fastest growing cities, we will have to continue to invest in our infrastructure to ensure that it meets the needs of our ever-growing population. Now, this project delivers on that vision and develops a system that will allow Durham residents, visitors, to experience a world-class facility to all their destinations. In 2022, the City of Durham Transportation Department was awarded $10.8 million from the Federal Transit Administration. An additional $13.5 million match comes from the Durham County Transit Plan. Funding will go towards aesthetic and functional improvements to this station that will enhance the overall rider experience. The new station will grow from 20 to 28 bus bays, increasing the volume of buses that can pass through this station. Plans also include adding more electric buses to the city's fleet. Go Durham already operates 8 electric buses, and Durham Transportation Director Sean Egan says the city hopes to add 18 more over the next several years. Transplants to the Triangle often move from cities where public transit is a feature of everyday life, but in Durham only about 4.5% of the population rides the bus on a regular basis. Many riders rely on the service for transport to work, school, or health care facilities. The city's transportation department has invested millions to improve bus service for current riders by building new signage, more shelters, as well as increasing the speed and volume of these bus trips. Mike Lee, a newly elected Durham County Commissioner, said, "The investment in Durham's public transit is a show of gratitude toward the city's blue-collar workers who rely on the bus for their livelihood." And Lee said, "When we think about these 14,000 riders who use Durham Station every day, many of them are essential workers. Now we're investing $26 million in a facility used by essential workers every day to provide better, safer, and more convenient transportation, and to do so in a setting that demonstrates at a glance that Durham is a community that values its essential workers." In March of 2020, the City Council made buses free to ride to reduce the spread of COVID-19. Now, Go Durham buses have remained fare-free since 2020, in part thanks to leftover ARPA grant funding, while some fares across the Go Triangle system have returned. The City Council and staff will decide whether to renew Durham's commitment to fare-free buses during next year's budget discussion. The City of Durham has made considerable investments in transportation. In October, the City Council voted 7-0 to adopt new design standards for this transit system. Those standards will guide new construction projects funded by the Streets and Sidewalks Bond that passed in November, and additional projects across the city in an effort to make transportation safer and more accessible. The new bus station won't just increase capacity for transit riders. Go Triangle will also have more capacity to continue offering regional transit options to Raleigh, Chapel Hill, and Research Triangle. In Raleigh, city officials are in the process of improving the Raleigh Union Station bus facility, known as the Russ Bus, which is scheduled to open next year. After the collapse of the light rail project, local officials have had to pivot to new options for regional transit. Brenda Howerton, former Durham County Commissioner, has been Go Triangle Board Chair since 2021. She said the renovated bus station is part of the organization's larger vision for a more connected transit system that prioritizes public transportation, a sentiment shared by many of the officials present at the groundbreaking. Howerton had this to say: "It's our commitment to the citizens of Durham and the region to build a future we want to see for Durham and the Triangle. The Durham Station enhancements provide an example for communities across the nation of what is possible when we come together and prioritize equity and sustainability in our transportation plans." Officials say this construction should take 2 years to complete and that the station will remain operational during the construction. All right, let's continue in the city of Durham with ambitious curbside food scraps collection pilot. Durham looks to cut landfill waste. Leftover food comes and goes easily. Wilted salad left from a potluck. Daily coffee grounds. The moldy butt of a loaf of bread. Slick potato peels from Thanksgiving prep. If you're like most people in Durham, all these scraps go promptly in the trash before being carted out to a curb and taking a 98-mile journey to a Sampson County landfill. Locally, for those wishing to forego landfill waste, two routes have traditionally been available: do-it-yourself backyard composting and paid services like Compost Now, a private company that offers pickup prices starting at $29 a month. These options could soon expand. Durham is currently piloting an ambitious food scrap curbside collection, the first city in North Carolina to do so. The city hopes to make this public service permanent someday. In 2016, the City of Durham's Solid Waste Management Department hired a consultant to gather and analyze household waste. The study entailed collecting a sample of waste and sorting it into categories: cardboard, plastics, metals, food scraps. Department Director Wayne Fenton says about 18% of what was in the waste stream was compostable food scraps, and by percentage, that was the largest component of what was sent to waste. So we made that a priority, to look at getting food scraps out of the landfills. Why? Keeping organic waste out of landfills reduces methane, a gas that contributes to climate change, significantly. In Sampson County, where waste from Durham, alongside 43 other North Carolina counties, go to die, those emissions are particularly egregious. According to a 2021 EPA figures, Sampson County ranks second in the nation for methane emissions, beating out 1,300 other municipal solid waste landfills for damage. Landfills, it says, tend to be disproportionately placed in low-income areas. North Carolina is no exception. Sampson County ranks 12th in poverty across the state, with a poverty level of 22.8%. Christine Whitmire, Organics Recycling Team Lead at the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, says EPA estimates that one-third of all food available for human consumption goes uneaten and is the most commonly landfilled material, responsible for 58% of the fugitive methane emissions at landfills. Composting food scraps creates green jobs, reduces emissions, and extends landfill life by saving valuable airspace. The practical outcome of the 2016 study came years later in 2022, when the city of Durham launched the first phase of its pilot program to collect and compost food scraps from city residents. The initiative is three-pronged. Education, an essential phase, came first. For habits to become truly reflexive, people need to grasp the full picture and feel incentivized. In the United States, the average household wastes a shocking third of the food it purchases. This translates to financial loss. In 2024 study, researchers found the average North Carolina household loses over $200,000 each year on food waste, a figure slightly higher than the national average of exactly $2,000. As part of this educational initiative, the city has encouraged backyard composting and run sales on composting units. When possible, this method is ideal, says Fenton. The city doesn't have to collect the waste, which means there's no cost involved, and the resident gets the finished product. The pilot's second phase, making drop-off containers and sites available to residents for food waste disposal, launched in July of this year. These sites, put in place through a partnership with Compost Now, are especially geared toward individuals living in apartments or other homes without outdoor space. One collection site is located at City Hall, another at the Waste Disposal and Recycling Center on East Club Boulevard. The containers are available to all city residents to use free of charge, though users must download an app, Compost Here, to unlock the containers and deposit food scraps. The Solid Waste Management Department plans to expand this program and has accounted for an additional 5 drop-off locations in its fiscal 25-26 budget request. These units will be distributed across the city to serve a broader population. And the third prong of the city's food scrap pilot is curbside collection. The pilot curbside program initially included 80 households in Walltown, a neighborhood chosen for the trial because it demographically mirrors Durham as a whole and because it's proximate to the Club Boulevard drop-off site. Each household participating in the pilot was provided with an indoor countertop container to collect food scraps, as well as an outdoor cart. The food scraps residents collect are picked up once a week. The first goal of this curbside program was to learn how to best communicate with community members about what items can and cannot be composted. It also provided an important time frame for collecting general feedback and learning what barriers might exist to food scrap collection. The trial has since expanded to include 440 households, and the city is exploring what the program could look like on a citywide scale, considering costs, benefits, and logistics. Participation in the pilot is free, and Fenton believes that the service should continue to be provided at no cost to residents, though annual budget changes ultimately need to be approved by City Council. And Fenton said, "If you're asking someone to spend additional time, sort food scraps, put it in a different cart, put it out on a different day, then you tell them you're going to charge them, you're not going to get as high a participation rate." Collaboration with other organizations has been central to putting program elements in place. In addition to its other partners, the city contracts with Atlas Organics, which composts the food scraps on-site at the Waste Disposal and Recycling Center. As with any public initiative, financing the program is critical. In this case, the Solid Waste Management Department received funding from the North Carolina Department of Environmental Quality, Division of Environmental Assistance and Customer Service, through its 2022 Community Waste Reduction and Recycling Grant Program to purchase these countertop bins and outdoor carts for the pilot. So far, this collection pilot has been received well. Of the 440 households, the only instances of participants leaving the pilot were due to individuals moving out of the area served. How the program might be eventually rolled out and budgeted is still up in the air, Fenton emphasizes. Collecting food scraps and composting is one of those things that's not particularly pretty or convenient. Unlike out-of-sight, out-of-mind disposal habits, it puts a process of interacting with smelly, slimy kitchen waste at the fore. Nevertheless, the popularity of public compost collection has surged around the country in years, with a recent study determining that about 12% of U.S. households have access to a food waste program, with about 400 programs concentrated in big cities like Chicago, Houston, San Diego. In 2022, California passed a bill requiring every jurisdiction to provide collection services for organic waste, an ambitious goal that's been met by about 75% of jurisdictions thus far. Another recent bill requires supermarkets to give away unsold food that is still good, an effort that squares waste reduction with efforts to fight hunger, another gargantuan problem in the United States where 13.5% of households are reportedly food insecure. And that direct interaction with household waste also has its benefits. Just as it's possible to shift disposal habits, it's possible that composting can also lead to greater shifts in environmental consciousness. Duke's Center for Advanced Hindsight and Applied Behavioral Science Research Center is another Durham pilot partner. Oh, wonderful, they should get a grant just for their name. Durham's Center for Advanced Hindsight. During the curbside collection pilot, it ran a study to see if composting households also see general waste levels reduced. Joseph Sherlock, a behavioral scientist there at the Center for Advanced Hindsight, says, "We were really interested in how taking on this new behavior changes the way people might think about themselves and whether they will develop any spillover behavior. For example, if someone starts sorting their food scraps, there's a chance they may make other environmentally friendly lifestyle adjustments, like eating less meat, driving less, or recycling more." Sherlock says of food waste, "It's a problem that we all need to solve, and it really can only be done at the local level." Observing the public's attitude towards composting and how the program has been received, Fenton draws parallels to recycling. And he says, "I've been working in this industry for quite a few years, and I'll just say the enthusiasm we saw in the past when curbside recycling first started, people were very interested and very willing, and communities saw it as a really good thing. We're kind of now revisiting this with food scraps. People are very interested. They hear about the issues with methane and greenhouse gases, and they would like to do their part. We don't want to be in the disposal business," he says, summing up that motivation behind his own work. "We want to be in the diversion business. We want to divert things from landfills." Okay, still from Durham. A Durham dad's vision to help adults with developmental disabilities. When Dave Curro opens the trunk of his car to reveal a model of the neighborhood he wants to build for developmentally disabled adults, the project looks like a distant dream. But when Curro points to a manhole on the property where he plans to build the complex, the idea doesn't seem so far-fetched. He calls it the Midtown Housing Coalition, an affordable housing development to give developmentally disabled adults an independent life. It would consist of 26 tiny homes surrounding an activity center and an event space. Curro, a 67-year-old retired quality engineer from Durham, conceived of the project more than 3 years ago, in part to give his son, Brett, 37, who is developmentally disabled, a place to live on his own. His goal is to start construction as soon as possible. Disabled veterans will also be invited to live in the small houses. Curro, who spends time at the American Legion in Durham, said he included them in the mandate for the project because he's a 50% disabled veteran. Curro anticipates that 3 to 4 of the 26 homes will be used to house members of this population. Among other conditions, developmental disabilities include autism spectrum disorder, Tourette syndrome, and Fragile X syndrome. That's according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. To reside in the new community, Curro said, a person needs to be independent enough to handle basic tasks like waking up on time in the morning and going to work. However, the community could hire an administrator to help residents carry out more complex tasks that are outside of daily routines, such as grocery shopping or paying utility bills. This would help them get the support they needed while removing the burden from caregivers like Curro. For Curro, it's vital that developmentally disabled adults learn to live independently of their parents. He asked, "If I get hit by a bus tomorrow, what happens to my son?" Brett used to live alone, but after it became no longer feasible due to his disability, he moved back in with his dad. He now works in the laundry department of a Durham hotel, where Curro says he's beloved by his colleagues. Although Curro has an impressive vision, it's clear that he still needs to work out key details. His website says he has an agreement with Habitat for Humanity to build the first 6 homes. However, a Habitat official declined to discuss the project with the 9th Street Journal, since the organization does not yet know how many structures will fit on the site. I might mention here that 9th Street Journal partners with Indie Week to produce some of the articles I read to you. Bethany United Methodist Church, which is adjacent to the site and owns property where the homes would be built, did not respond to calls from 9th Street Journal. Curro said the church was hesitant to accept the project at first. In response, Curro and the other 2 board members of the Midtown Housing Coalition with developmentally disabled adult children brought their kids to meet church members. The meeting went well, and since then, Curro said the church has been on board. Last spring, he organized a spring fling fundraiser in that church's parking lot, which included live music, games, barbecue, face painting. The church even whipped up its famous in-house stew, which it makes in a designated stew hut behind the main church building that's normally reserved for special church events. A Durham County Commissioner and State Senator Mike Woodard were in the attendance, too. Curro said that he and the church are negotiating a contract for the lots, but that it takes a long time to reach an agreement. So far, he has, quote, submitted a letter of intent to the church, and they verbally agreed to the project. Once the church and Midtown Housing sign a contract, Curro plans to sell the lots to Habitat at cost, at which point Habitat can begin construction and later sell the homes. The lack of certainty hasn't deterred Kuro, whose vision is clear and detailed, and in the case of his model, includes miniature cars, streets, and shrubs. The development will be situated around the community center, where residents can host activities for all members of the complex. Kuro gives the example of a WWE wrestling party on Friday nights. He says the location is ideal because it's close to a bus line, which will help residents who work downtown or who are veterans visiting the VA health center. The tiny homes provide independence and ease for daily structure, but not too much space. Kuro's next big task is landing a meeting with the mayor, Leonardo Williams. The goal is for Williams to waive certain fees and taxes, like utilities and public schools, for residents of the complex. Kuro also needs permission to bypass rules on how many tiny homes can be built on the church property. He realizes he still has some hurdles to turn his dream into reality, but he's determined to make it happen. And he says, if you don't have a target, you're not going to ever hit it. All right, on over to Carrboro. As I read last week, I believe, or 2 weeks ago anyway, Carrboro's lawsuit against Duke Energy make national news, but comes as no surprise. And on Wednesday, Carrboro Mayor Barbara Fouché announced the town is bringing a first-of-its-kind lawsuit against Duke Energy. In the 70-page complaint filed in Orange County Superior Court, Carrboro attacks the utility's alleged, quote, knowing deception campaign concerning the causes and dangers posed by the climate crisis, arguing that the company misled the public by downplaying the impact of burning fossil fuels. It also seeks to hold the company responsible for damages to the town and its infrastructure due to the increased severity of storms, flooding, and temperature caused by climate change. Fouché said at a press conference in the town hall's council chambers, we've been tracking damages from climate change, and it's clear that our town and hard-working taxpayers cannot and should not be forced to pay this. Excuse me, I'll restart this, not restart it. Anyway, Ms. Fouché, behind her and the assembled council, which voted unanimously for this measure, posters spelled out Carrboro versus fossil fuels and stop climate deception. The mayor said this was not an easy decision to make, but I have abundant faith in our town's bold courage and a commitment to protecting our community and our planet. Other municipalities have sued oil and gas companies, but Carrboro is the first to target an electric utility. In national news about the lawsuit, Carrboro has been labeled a town next to Chapel Hill and a town about 36 miles northwest of Raleigh, as if the lawsuit emerged from a sleepy void in the old North State. But for anyone familiar with Carrboro's ultra-progressive reputation, it probably doesn't come as a surprise that this town of 21,000 is taking aggressive legal action against one of the country's largest electric companies. Mayor Pro Tem Danny Nowell told Indy at this press conference, for decades, Carrboro residents have proven themselves some of the boldest and most progressive residents in North Carolina. Indeed, the town, sometimes cheekily referred to as the People's Republic of Carrboro, became the first municipality in the state to elect an openly gay mayor in 1995 when Mike Nelson won nearly 50% of the vote. In 1994, it became the first in the state to grant benefits to same-sex partners of town employees. Outside Carrboro's town hall, where officials posed for a photo after this press conference, a giant wreath is flanked by LGBTQ Pride and Black Lives Matter flags. Earlier this year, the council was the first in the state to call on Congress to back a ceasefire in Gaza, although the resolution split the council on a 4-3 vote. In the early 2000s, Carrboro was the first participating municipality to launch the plenty, a local currency meant to supplement the dollar. And in recent years, the town has had conversations about renaming itself because its namesake, Julian Carr, was a slave owner. Although those talks have stalled because the change would require approval from the state legislature. Part of that comes from the town's culture. Carrboro, per the independently produced 2006 certified banger of a song, It's Carrboro. It's, quote, a place where the hippies and the hipsters meet. Combine that with a ridiculously high educated populace. About 70% of adults hold at least a bachelor's degree, compared to 34% statewide. And the lawsuit seems more like a natural next step rather than a bizarre stunt by a progressive hub. In the complaint, Carrboro alleges that it has and will continue to lose millions of dollars due to the impact of climate change. Those costs include road maintenance, stormwater infrastructure, and electricity costs, ironically paid to Duke Energy to keep buildings cool during heat waves. The lawsuit, though, is one cost the town will not need to bear, as N.C. Warren, a nonprofit, is funding it. The town's also partnering with the Nonprofit Center for Biological Diversity. In a statement to the Indy, Duke Energy said it's in the process of reviewing the complaint. Quote, Duke Energy is committed to its customers and communities and will continue working with policymakers and regulators to deliver reliable and increasingly clean energy while keeping rates as low as possible. Unquote. Next, voices. Who deserves to die? Not the 136 people currently on death row in Raleigh, writes Amanda Abrams. I'm repeatedly struck by my friend Rodney Taylor's need to put his voice out into the world. When he and I talk on the phone or exchange messages, he'll tell me about the novel he's working on, his third, this time providing social commentary along with the story, and the book of essays that's gradually coming together. The podcast that started as a blog has been on hiatus for a few months, but he and his collaborators are planning a new set of episodes for 2025. And then there's the youth program he launched around 2015, ostensibly about chess, but ultimately providing mentorship and life lessons to young people. That took place in a community center in New York, where he's from. Taylor designed the initiative and helped direct it by phone from afar until COVID put a lid on things. He's hoping to get back to it eventually. Recently, he expanded the curriculum from 26 pages to over 200 and will be ready to start things up again when the time is right. When I ask Taylor why he's so determined to have an impact, I can hear the shrug in his voice. I guess I've tried to make the best of my situation and figure out how I can use what I know to be productive, he explains. I suppose that's what many of us aim to do with our talents and time, but Taylor's situation is unusual. Since 1998, he's been incarcerated in Unit 3 in NC Central Prison in Raleigh, our state's death row. Half a lifetime ago, 26-year-old Taylor was caught up in the drug trade and killed a man in Wilmington while visiting from New York, and he was sentenced to death and has been here ever since, waiting to be executed. I met him in 2016 when I began leading a meditation group on the unit, and we stayed in touch after it ended. Taylor is, of course, far from alone. There are 134 men and two women on death row, all hovering in a kind of limbo. Since the last execution in 2006, North Carolina has been experiencing a de facto death penalty moratorium. Executions have been halted because of lawsuits related to the state's lethal injection protocol and to racial justice issues around the men's conviction and sentencing. Now a group of advocates is pushing to convert that unofficial pause into something more permanent. The North Carolina Coalition for Alternatives to the Death Penalty is urging Governor Cooper to commute all 136 death sentences to prison terms before he leaves office on December 31. Their campaign has included demonstrations, petitions, op-eds, reports, billboards, and a 136-mile march from Winston-Salem to Raleigh. One of their key points is that the current situation could change at any time. Kristen Collins, Director of Public Information at the Durham-based Center for Death Penalty Litigation, a coalition member, says the status quo of executions being held at bay cannot last forever. Once the lawsuits are resolved, and with Republicans controlling the state Supreme Court, the decisions may well be unfavorable for those on death row. The state could experience a flood of executions. And yet, says Collins, these are people who wouldn't be sentenced to death today. They're really old sentences under very different laws. There are lots of reforms that have happened since then. More than a third of the men on Unit 3 are over 60 years old, and the majority were convicted in the 1990s. A distinctly different era in criminal justice, and one in which the death penalty had much more public support. Back then, factors like trauma, age, and mental illness were given less weight, and far less attention was paid to issues of racial justice. According to the coalition, nearly half the people on death row were tried by juries that were wholly white or included only one person of color. Taylor knows these details. He and the other men are paying attention. Most, like Taylor himself, have filed petitions for clemency through their lawyers. No one's particularly optimistic. Taylor says, I've been hearing they're going to get rid of that death penalty since before I got here. After 27 years, you're like, man, it's not going to happen. He's gradually found a way to make peace, some peace at least, with his circumstances. In his early years on the row, Taylor recognized that something had gone very wrong in his life for him to wind up there. In response, he says, all I've done since I've been here is work on myself and try to be a better person. In an effort to gain insight into himself and those around him, he writes every day, something he's loved doing since he was 11. He's not the only one who long ago turned introspective. During the almost 3 years that I led weekly meditation groups on the unit, I met many sincere and heartfelt men. Most had been there for decades and had developed very close bonds with one another. Those relationships and their many years in confinement have gradually softened them and worn them smooth. Taylor says that's unsurprising. Quote, it's like a boxed-in life here. But human beings aren't meant to be boxed in. We're meant to spread out and explore the world. So when you're locked inside, you explore your mind. You explore yourself. You might say they're grasping for redemption. That's an ancient word that comes with heavy religious overtones, but in this case it fits. Many of these men are now very different people than they were when they arrived years ago, without the hard and ugly edges that originally brought them here. Like Taylor, they've turned away from their bad deeds and are aiming to make something of themselves. To be clear, I don't believe anyone should be killed as punishment, whether they've transformed or not. It's not fair, just, or even logical. But I do wonder if Governor Cooper has any sense of what the men on Unit 3 are like now, what they've gone through, how they've changed. I understand the governor might not be finished with his political career, and commuting more than 100 sentences could be a drag on that future, as well as on the state's Democratic Party writ large. But he's a good person, I firmly believe that. And he's the only one who can grant clemency, another ancient word, to the state's death row residents. The people there have, in a very real sense, done their time. How could executing them now ever be the right thing to do? Now, folks, from December, probably from the end of November, I've held this interview with author Nate DiMeo in the back of my folder. And this seems to be a time when I have 17 minutes. I can probably read it. It's a book about a book called The Memory Palace, True Stories of the Past. And was released, I guess it's a, what is it, a podcast? It's a podcast. Anyway, the talk was, this was the podcast, was the Center for Documentary Studies in Durham on December 2nd. So, the writer, Nate DiMeo, in a new book, The Memory Palace, True Stories of the Past, DiMeo introduces a slate of characters that traverse with keen wonder through the annals of history. Grape pickers march across California with Cesar Chavez. A socialite moves to Wisconsin to study prairie chickens. A child sits on a roof for years trying to photograph the solar system. As with DiMeo's popular long-running podcast of the same name, all these characters are real people, lifted from the past and given, in DiMeo's grave, sonorous voice, brief poetic treatment. In the book version of the popular podcast, which is released by Random House on November the 19th, fans will find new stories, photographs, and other ephemera alongside favorite show segments. Ahead of a December the 2nd book tour stop at Duke's Center for Documentary Studies, DiMeo sat down with the indie to talk about the process of putting the book together and how learning about the past can crack open greater possibilities for the present. This interview has been edited and condensed for length and clarity. Also, you'll hear me attempting to do a Q&A format where I'll make my voice softer and sound like an interviewer. Just because that's something to do. How did you determine which stories belong in the book? At this point, he says, there have been 223 stories in the 16 years of Memory Palace, and so there was a lot of picking and choosing about what would work and which thing hinged upon sound too much, and which ones would work on the page and which ones wouldn't. As a kid, there were so many books that were collections of short pieces that my dad had purchased, probably for like a dime each, these old paperbacks of Ripley's Believe It or Not stories or Guinness Book of World Records, these things you might pick up off the shelf over and over. And 6 months later, you'd read something, and you'd be that little bit older, and suddenly this one would click. People have talked to me about the show, and that's kind of the way it works. People listen to some stories, but every once in a while, one will knock them out. And there's something about it that speaks to them in their life. I was thinking back to those books that I loved so much as a kid. What happens when you build one of those for adults, where the randomness is the point? You open the book up and are not expecting to laugh, and suddenly you are, or you're not expecting to cry, and suddenly you are. A book that could sneak up on you. Books used to do that all the time as a kid, and they stopped doing that when you're an adult. I wanted to bring a little bit of that back. Was that part of the decision not to order things chronologically? Yeah, absolutely. Part of the way the show works is that you go in cold, by design. It is anti-algorithmic in that way. I'm sure I could probably find more listeners if I could maximize my SEO and, you know, follow some like Mr. Beast format and figure out exactly how to entice and hook people. Please don't. Yes, thank you. Thank you. The truth of the matter is, I know that if you tell someone, here's a story about the second woman to ever cross the English Channel, or here's this woman who made sculptures in butter, you might think, I don't care about this woman who makes sculptures in butter, but I want you to, and I don't want you to come in with your guard up so I don't tell you what it's going to be. In this book, I continue to do that. There's no table of contents. You enter each story cold, and with the first line, hopefully, it will raise some mystery or question that you want to be answered with the next one. I'm curious what you feel the difference may be to listening to this material versus reading it. It's a leap of faith, and I do think for me in particular it was a difficult one to make because as a person talking, you know what a good audio sentence is, and I have more faith in that than I might in a good book sentence. Music can do a lot of work, and pacing can do a lot of work. Dramatic pauses are dramatic for a reason, and it's difficult to simulate a dramatic pause on the page. What I've noticed is that sort of imaginary space that all history has to live in, because we have no other way to access it, there's a conjuring act that feels like magic. I realize it's the same thing that happens when you read. If you're reading a Jane Austen novel and riding the bus, part of you is on that bus and part of you is in the Cotswolds in 1805 or whatever. Holding those two spaces is wonderful. I started to notice that that's the same way that history and memory live. It kind of occupies the present at the same time. In the same way, if you walk in the dog and part of you is back in the argument you're going over your head that you had the night before, or you're reading a book and it's a dry, factual account of Gettysburg, and part of you is on that battlefield, and part of you is, again, on that bus. The thing that kind of cracked how I could tell these stories was realizing that it was the same as the book. What you're doing is giving details and describing things using the same tools of poetic devices or literary devices and trying to create that same kind of fictional space. And that there was nothing wrong in doing that because the facts were there and it was accurate in that fictional space. Which is all we ever have of the past. In the introduction, you talk about how when learning about a historical figure, there can be this moment, some decision or action the figure takes, where they feel real. I wonder about the importance of that kind of moment when, in our own age, there's AI and misinformation, and people are having a harder time putting a shape around the present and what is real. I'm very aware of how miasmic and conflicted the present always is. If we were to go back in time right now and it was 2012 or 2009 and things weren't so crazy with social media, fake news and AI was but a glimmer in some mathematician's eye, life is really chaotic. Even then, it was really chaotic. You'd read something very practical and normal like the New York Times opinion page, and there'd be nine different things that were explaining, you know, the Obama administration or whatever was happening, and you would not buy some of it, and you would be like, I think Maureen Dowd is wrong about this thing. The truth of the matter is the story that all these people are telling about the present. You can argue about all this stuff all the time because we do. The present itself is always so contingent and up for debate. It's always this process of coming to a mutual understanding through language and stories. So why shouldn't the past be anything else? If there's anything that I'm trying to remember or let my readers know about the past, it is that it is just like the present. The people in the past were just like us and were real people. Sometimes it's hard to remember the people we read about in the news today are real. It takes a leap of imagination to put yourself in their shoes or even in the shoes of the person who's a couple rows away on that bus. To me, there's something really valuable about looking to the past and seeing the ways in which people's lives are constricted or determined or enabled by the economic condition and rules and mores of the day, and what was simply in the air they breathed or the work they were allowed to do. It reminds me that the present is no different. Our time now is itself historical, and it snaps me into a kind of presence. All the strangeness and disassociation and unreality of the present, all very pointed right now, because the questions about AI are so present, the truth is, I think it was there all the time. We just had a bit more comfort in the things we were hanging our hats on, and now it feels like our hat is going to fall if we hang it on this piece of news or that piece of news. I don't want you to feel like you have to give any spoilers away about your event, but are you going to reference some stories from North Carolina? Is that right? What will go down at this event is that I'll tell stories for a while, then I'll have a conversation about the book and process and stuff like that. A lot of the stories are pretty dynamic and set to music. There are visuals and some pretty incredible animations that over time I've commissioned and worked with people on. And I will also be reading, including a North Carolina story that's really pivotal in the book about the Outer Banks. It's a good time. It really is. So, Mr. DiMeo, Nate DiMeo, D-I-M-E-O, The Memory Palace, True Short Stories of the Past, and or the podcast, which is probably available somewhere. I hadn't read that before I read it to you, and I think I'll take this article home and read it again. He writes very interestingly about this, that the past is, the people are just the same in certain important ways as they are now. Well, as usual, I'll probably have a couple of these articles from today's edition and from a couple of other of the past articles still in my briefcase that I can pull out, like the last one. Here's one that was actually in the newspaper on the 26th of November, and it's about an iron pour, P-O-U-R. And I'll read as much of that as I can before we close. In the heart of Durham, Central Park, on Saturday, orange plastic fences surround three large furnaces where the fires burn at 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. It's 4:30 p.m., and against a hard hip-hop beat, student teams and pour masters, or experienced iron sculptors, feed iron blocks into the furnaces. As flames build, the furnaces melt the iron into a red, lava-like substance that oozes into sculpture molds. The molds move down a conveyor belt as students from local universities shovel them off to the side to cool. Nearby, a brown metal dragon spits fire upwards in the middle of Foster Street, welcoming guests to the 8th annual Iron Pour, hosted by Liberty Arts, a local arts organization and foundry. The event's free, but each time a guest donates $20 to the organization, the dragon's flames roar, contributing to the symphony of music and chatter. Just past the stage, with a DJ, Kaisia Collins and Larissa Wood stand in front of a white tent, beckoning people over to a large blank canvas waiting to be covered in paint. Wood shouts over the music, "I feel like art is always fun to witness and experience. It brings some levity, but also just some variety and excitement." Underneath the green awning, tracing the edges of the park, is an art market where hordes of people pause to gaze at clay dishes, vibrant art prints, multicolored marbles, sarcastic greeting cards, and an iron caster's gallery. Leah Fouché-Waller wanders through the caster's gallery, hesitating at each iron sculpture. Her eyes linger on the hard lines, taking in a circular bronze sculpture with cutouts of thin circles at the top, jagged edges at the bottom, and a mask-like face in the center. This is far from Fouché-Waller's first time at the event. She was here 8 years ago when Trip Jarvis, a local sculptor, and one of this evening's pour masters brought the iron pour to Durham, Central Park, for the first time. Fouché-Waller has been a part of Liberty Arts since its founding. She and her husband, Michael Waller, were recruited in the early 2000s to build Major, the iconic bull statue in downtown Durham out of bronze. The public was able to watch the casting process in an open-air pavilion at the end of Liberty Warehouse. This project laid the foundation for Liberty Arts' creation as a non-profit foundry, eventually expanding to include 13 studio artists offering classes in glass blowing, ceramics, metals, jewelry, wood, and painting. Scanning the park, Fouché Waller points out her former students, along with previous students of her husband, and their former East Carolina University professor, Carl Billingsley, who have returned to the event as volunteers, pour masters, and guests. The Iron Pour is an extension of Liberty Arts' educational mission, she says, to create experiences that enhance artistic growth and community building through art-making practices. So, in essence, the Iron Pour is a macro version of that artist or that experience. A more micro version would be teaching a class to a small group of students on how to make glass pumpkins. Fouché Waller returns to the Iron Casters Gallery, stopping to listen to the resounding drums of Batala Durham. Across from the Iron Gallery, William Davis, the former Hillsborough poet laureate, sits behind a gray typewriter, smiling at the little girl in front of him, who whispers a poem request. Nearby children race between multicolored typewriters, smashing the keys as they attempt to write on the note cards. The Iron Pour, Davis says, makes people aware of what can happen. And this is just a culmination of what Durham is supposed to be every single day. Just then, the crowd gasps. Beyond the fence, red, hot metal balls rain down from the sky and spatter across the dirt. The students scurry away, and the atmosphere eventually relaxes as the MCs strike a light note. One artist, whose personal protective equipment failed, sustained a minor injury. Event organizers later said no students or attendees were harmed. Not far away, representatives of Shop Space, a Raleigh metalworking shop, demonstrate how to forge a hammer using long metal tongs to pull a red-hot piece of iron out of a miniature furnace. And our little furnace must come to a halt right now because our time is expired. John Feddersen for ncreadingservice.org encourages you to listen to this broadcast later if you want as a podcast, or come again next week anytime. We save all the old broadcasts for Indie Week. Then John Feddersen says goodbye for now.